Hey, everybody. Joe here from the Lines Led by Donkeys podcast, but I guess you probably already knew that. If you like what we do here on the show, consider supporting us on Patreon at www.patreon.com/linesledbydonkeys. Just $5 per month gets you every regular episode early, access to our community Discord, a digital copy of my book, The Hooligans of Kandahar, as well as its audiobook read by me, and over 5 years of bonus content. By supporting the show, you support us and allow us to keep our show, as it has always been, ad-free. Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoy the show.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to the Lions Led by Donkeys podcast. Since you're hearing my voice doing the introduction, you can probably guess that we're going to be talking about some things that explode.
I've been kidnapped.
And if you can hear that voice, you know that I am joined by your usual host, Joe. Hello, Joe.
Hello. The controls have been wrested away from my dying mitts, and we have once again handed the banner of the Legion over to Tom, our Irish terror correspondent.
I mean, listen, the amount of stuff I had to read about political theory for this this series, I feel like you would have killed yourself, so.
Yeah. As I've often said, I would rather functions check an AK with my mouth than read political theory.
I mean, you're going to hear a lot about it in this episode.
I don't have an AK with me because I live in the Netherlands and my constitutional freedoms are being infringed upon.
Committing seppuku with a very sharp stroopwafel.
Yeah, I'm going to have to just bludgeon myself to death with a large wheel of chowda or like a clog. I'm not entirely sure. I can sharpen a field hockey stick and just go to town on my own limbs until I bleed out.
Yeah. So since you are now on the other side of hosting duties, how are you doing, buddy?
Oh, you know, I'm fine. We're currently having a hell of a lot of windstorms where I live, which is very common in The Hague. However, I underestimated said windstorm. I had to go grocery shopping today. And like any good person who lives in the Netherlands, I go grocery shopping on my bicycle. I was nearly blown into traffic, which is impressive because the bike lane is completely separate from the road. My bike was pushed so far off the bike lane, I almost went into the street as a large like semi truck was barreling past. It was a close call.
I mean, like, given our pre-recording conversation, you do have the body mass index of a plastic bag, so.
And much like a plastic bag blowing on the wind, I am beautiful.
Yeah, do you ever feel like a plastic bag floating through the wind, wanting to start again?
Fuck off.
Yeah, we were talking before we started recording. Last Friday, it was like the first sunny day in the UK. So like immediately I finished work and I was like, fuck it, go to the pub. And there's not a huge amount of nice pubs in my area. Like I live kind of in a rough enough area in London. And I was like, do you know what? I want to go somewhere a bit nicer where I can like sit outside and enjoy some drinks. So did, got off the train, arrived. Of course, there's like 200 people standing outside and there's a 20-minute queue to the bar to get a pint. So
Jesus Christ.
But do you know what? The weather was nice. I didn't mind. Had my drinks and then stayed there for like the entire evening. And at one point, you know, nature calls. I had to use the toilet. And I had what I can only describe as the most London experience ever.
Mm-hmm.
I got shamed for shitting in the cocaine toilet.
Okay, hold on here. Are you telling me that, okay, I've been to London twice now. I will never say I have had a London experience. You know, I've been there for work. As some listeners have probably seen me there.
I mean, you lived dietarily off, you know, ready meals from a Sainsbury's, so it's close enough.
Yeah, that is true. So you're saying if you go into a pub, and I've been to a few pubs, there's really only like a men's, women's stall, effectively. There's only really ever like the piss trough and then the shit hole, right? Like, so if you go into the actual closed door, it's considered a party foul because that's where you're supposed to be doing cocaine.
So essentially this bar is, it's like tiny. It's, I'd say like 12 square meters inside, and that's being generous. And the only toilets are, there's like two enclosed stalls, fully enclosed stalls in the bar. So like the bar counter ends, then there's two toilets. So I had to go to the toilet and queued up, and there's like a couple of people waiting in front of me. Queue was moving very quickly, so I very quickly realized not a whole lot of people, you know, using the toilet, washing their hands, etc., etc. So I go in, do my business, and I'm no more than like 5 minutes, probably less, get up, and I'm like washing my hands, and this dude starts slamming on the door, and he's like, mate, there's people waiting. And I'm like, okay. So then I like dry my hands, make sure to take a lot of time drying my hands, make sure they're completely dry, and go out, and this dude is just like wide-eyed, and he's like, mate, there's people waiting, come on. And they're just like so indignant that I actually used the toilet to go to the bath, like go to the toilet.
If you're going to have a designated cocaine toilet, you got to have some kind of system to let everybody know it's the cocaine toilet. Like, I don't know, hang a fucking tie from the doorknob that resembles your broken dreams. This is why you're doing so much coke in a pub in London.
Yeah. And it was like, this is the thing when you move to the UK, like not just in London, but everywhere, it's just like everyone is doing cocaine. In any place, there's people in a Toby Carvery, probably as you're listening to this right now, doing bumps after their dinner.
I do remember someone posting a picture to Twitter, it's probably quite a while ago now, where they walked in a Nando's bathroom and someone was doing cocaine. Like, man, who's doing lines at Nando's?
Yeah. So I was just like, whatever, and walked past, and then just got outside and immediately texted the group chat with me, you, and Nate. It was like, just got Shane for shitting in the cocaine toilet.
I think cocaine toilet might just be the name of this episode. I had a recent, it wasn't that recent, interesting bathroom experience where I was in Georgia and I was waiting in line to use the bathroom. Now, I mean Tbilisi, Georgia. I'm not Atlanta. I've never been to that Georgia, weirdly enough. And the line is very, very long. And I'm noticing that there is like nobody's in line to the bathroom by themselves except me. And then it dawns on me, I'm queuing up for the fuck toilet. But like, I really have to use the bathroom, right? And I speak no Georgian. A fair amount of Georgians speak English. And I ask them like, yo, can I like go ahead of you? You know, because of the implication of, and the guy looks me dead in the eyes like, oh no, you can go ahead. You actually have to use the bathroom. And I was like, thank you. And I promptly pissed in the fuck toilet and got the fuck out of there. I didn't touch anything. I was just like, no, thank you.
Well, you know, with the idea of the fucking cocaine toilet being a matter of, you know, practical praxis, I think maybe we should get to the meat and potatoes of this episode. Joe is sighing silently.
I just don't like the idea of the fuck cocaine toilet leads into the topic.
It doesn't. I just needed to segue because we're nearly 10 minutes in.
Fair enough. I'm doing your job now. Anyway, the cock destroyers.
Listen, I can talk about fuck the episode. We can just talk about that if you want.
There's someone listening that has not watched the live episode and they have no fucking idea what we're talking about. So let's just leave it hanging in the air.
If you don't know what I mean, subscribe at the $10 tier on the Patreon. You can watch the video of the live shows where I just completely derail the entire show. But anyway, so Joe, before we begin, I want to ask you, how much do you know about the group The Weather Underground?
Actually, virtually nothing. The only thing that comes to my mind is I remember at the little fringes of my memory that still works around 2008. When Barack Obama was running for president, people kept saying that he was connected to Bill Ayers. And I was like, who the fuck is that? Like, oh, he ran a terrorist organization called the Weather Underground. I'm like, well, that's weird. I didn't know that that meteorologists had guns. And then I just moved on with my life. That's literally all I know about it.
So before we get into it, just want to acknowledge our sources. The first is Ron Jacobs, The Way the Wind Blew, published by Verso Books. And the other is Bill Ayers' own autobiography, Fugitive Days, which was published on 9/11.
2001.
Yep.
Oh, that is a great time for what I'm going to assume is a vaguely violent terror organization guy to put out a memoir.
I mean, like, look, we'll talk
about... I assume a lot of people didn't buy this book that day.
Yeah.
Like, people weren't queuing up for that one.
showing up to the signing of Fugitive Days on 9/11. It's like the guy who bowled the perfect 300 on 9/11. Just like,
nobody's going to remember you for that. Yeah.
So we've previously talked on this show about different, you know, revolutionary and terror groups that emerged out of the 20th century fighting for a variety of causes. We've talked about the IRA and unionist groups in Northern Ireland who fought over what would become of the nation and their communities. The Red Army faction, which was born against the legacy of fascism in Germany and the failure of denazification and the injustice of the Vietnam War. So the interesting thing about the Republican movement and the Red Army faction, despite having different ideologies and different motivations and being from different parts of the world, is they were both in part motivated by what was happening in the US. In our series on the Troubles, we spoke about how Bernadette Devlin and other similar Irish Republican activists were motivated by the works of desegregationists and the civil rights movement of people, you know, like MLK, and feeling a kinship with those suffering under institutional discrimination. The Red Army faction, on the other hand, being motivated by the war visited upon the Vietnamese people by the US military as a kind of proxy war against the encroaching threat of communism during the late 60s, and took it upon themselves to destabilize the German government, which they saw as complicit in the ongoing atrocities. Both of these groups saw the news in the US as the news of the world, one that would also echo throughout the world. What about what was happening in the US, and what about those who were active in the US? Who was fighting the good fight from the inside?
Well, it's the 60s, right? 60s, 70s? Certainly nothing bad's happening in the US during that time.
Hold that thought. So you had groups like the Black Panthers, who were combining community programs and grassroots organizing with radicalism to achieve self-determination by whatever means necessary. You had other kind of regional groups who were, you know, fighting on different fronts for different things.
This is the era of like the Symbionese Liberation Army.
Oh, Joe,
like that.
Hold that thought. Hold that thought for part two.
Those dudes always confused me, but okay.
We'll talk about it. Bear in mind, part two is almost 50% longer than part one.
Outstanding.
So, instead of talking about discriminating against people fighting for the right to be equal in life, we're talking about some college students from Michigan.
God damn it. Where in Michigan? Is it University of Michigan or Michigan State?
University of Michigan. We're talking about Ann Arbor, baby.
Motherfucker. Like, I'm just going to say, the fact this came out of U of M, of course it did.
So, we'll get into it. It's not necessarily just out of U of M, but particular people who are very prominent in it were in U of M.
You Wolverine fucks.
So to understand the group that would become the Weather Underground, it's important to understand the landscape at the time, and to do that we have to talk about everyone's favorite topic, and particularly Joe's favorite topic, student politics.
Let me guess. Let me try to do a too long didn't read here, right?
Yeah.
Okay. One particular asshole's gonna think he's smarter than everyone else. Soon a group of like-minded aggrandizement problems are going to coalesce around this person, and then they're all gonna fuck, and then that group is going to break apart.
You're 25% of the way there.
Fuck! Only 25%.
So, within the United States, the anti-racist and anti-war movements constituting the new left had been growing in leaps and bounds since the late 1950s, so part of this was born out of the post-war 50s, you know, the anti-Korean War as well. And the groups like these were taking on thousands of new members by the 1960s, and they began to develop a more radical approach in their analysis and activities. These approaches were partly reactions to the intensification of what would be the war in Vietnam, so scaling up the introduction of the draft, and the belief that a new kind of fascism was on the rise in the United States. This fascism was manifested politically in the new concern over law and order, and experienced socially in the increasing use of brutal police methods during protests and insurrections. I don't think you really need me to give you examples of, you know, the U.S. state overstepping the line in terms of violence in the 60s.
It seems completely foreign to me. That certainly couldn't happen, like, all the time.
Yep, yep.
As a means to crush both student movements and civil rights movements? No, that doesn't sound American at all.
Yeah, but for those uninitiated, for example, during the riots following Dr. Martin Luther King's murder, Mayor Richard Daley of Chicago ordered the police to shoot to kill any looters. This is what we're dealing with.
That's not that surprising coming from Richard Daley, to be completely honest. I mean, we're also not, you know, too far removed from things like Kent State happening. Mm-hmm. Where
Kent State comes up.
Of course it does. I mean, you can't talk about student movements during the Vietnam War without talking about the time that the National Guard murdered a bunch of college kids. And, you know, then there was other ones, I believe it was in Mississippi, where cops in the National Guard literally bayoneted students.
Yep. So the response of the new left to the ongoing political climate was to develop a more coherent stance towards the liberal conservative establishment, really kind of understanding the two-party system and how it affects daily life. No longer were particular racist policies or murderous acts protested. Instead, the new left sought to acknowledge the totality of social and political injustice in the US, a system that it came to label as Joe's favorite word, imperialist.
Mm. Well, I mean, they're not wrong.
Yeah.
So, occasionally, student groups do nail this one.
So the new left, as it developed, was composed mainly of several different youth-centered groups, each having a differing stance on what was to be done. The main ones at the time that are important to the history of the Weather Underground are the SDS, the PL, and the Yippies. The White Panthers...
The what? The fucking what?
We'll get there. So the SDS, or the Students for Democratic Society, essentially was the face of the New Left in America. Its newspaper, the New Left Notes, became the central forum through which young left-wing and politically active people were gathering talking points and ideas all across the country. Now, a fun side note and a fun fact, the reason why New Left Notes and other particular underground publications were able to stay in business, aside from, you know, funding from membership fees and donations, was advertising and the birth of youth culture in the 50s and 60s. If you want to...
I was going to assume Gaddafi. I'm going to be honest with you. I thought you were going to go with the Gaddafi one on me.
I mean, maybe Gaddafi had shares in Capitol Records. Who knows?
Maybe he was posting ads for like his local people's Jamahari, you know?
Yeah, so if you want to learn more about that sort of stuff, read a great book called Thomas Frank's Conquest of Cool. It's how, you know, companies took over the counterculture movement. But yeah, while they were partially funded by membership fees with various different groups, a lot of record labels like Capitol and RCA advertised in their pages to sell that hip new rock sound to the young people. Keep this in mind for later in this episode.
Okay, okay. I do think it's very funny that they were running. I mean, like, I think it's very, very stupid when someone like believes like, oh, how can you have like leftist political beliefs if you still make money? You know, like you only can be like true leftist. You only can have true leftist ideas and beliefs if you wear like a barrel for clothing and you don't have, and you smelt pig iron in your backyard. But there is a kind of funny irony about the newspaper surviving off of ads.
Oh, Joe.
I'm not faulting him for it. It's just kind of, it's funny. It's funny.
Wait until we talk about a particular event that happens in August 1969, which happens later in this episode.
Okay.
So the SDS were the largest group nationally, and within it there were also factions like the PL or Progressive Labour, who were an older sectarian group of Marxist-Leninists who were anti-Soviet and anti-nationalist. The idea of nationalism will come in quite strongly later in this episode.
You're telling me that this student movement had various different factions that didn't see eye to eye? I don't believe you.
Joe, we have another 8 pages of this. Of just this.
Also, like, it's kind of funny that the one Marxist-Leninist group in the U.S. during this time, not the one, but this one, managed to get on its feet and move and also still hate the Soviet Union. It's like, you must have not been popular at parties. I mean, even these parties for unpopular people. Nobody wants to go to a party full of, like, of theory brains, you know?
Yeah. There was also the Yippies, or the Youth International Party, who were more focused on radicalizing the burgeoning youth culture in the U.S. and were a more radical offshoot of the anti-war free speech rhetoric of the SDS. So, and we'll talk about this in a second, how essentially all these groups placed emphasis in different places, and it essentially creates the Weather Underground.
Okay.
So
Yippies is a terrible name, I should point out.
Yeah.
Sounds like a daytime show for children. Like the Wiggles, but for political ideology.
The Yippies would have been like a great alternative name for the Red Army factions. Oh yes, Yippie! We asked fighting denazification.
Just don't ask us to go on a hunger strike.
Don't ask us to shower. So one thing that united all of these groups was their opposition to U.S. hegemony, both domestically and abroad. And this manifested in support among the groups for the civil rights movement and the end to U.S. imperialism abroad. By the mid-1960s, most of these groups were focused on organizing demonstrations in support of equality and the small-scale protesting of businesses and organizations still racially discriminating against African Americans and other minorities after the passing of the Civil Rights Act in 1964. It was around this time that Bill Ayers from Ann Arbor, one of the founding members of the Weather Underground, would attend University of Michigan and be exposed to the hip new happenings of radical politics of the 1960s.
God. Well, what was his major? Do you know?
So have a guess, Joe, what he was studying.
Like, the easy answer is political science, right? So I'm going to go with anthropology.
He was studying American studies.
The fuck does that mean?
It's like politics, economics, philosophy. It's like PPL stuff.
Huh. Gotta say, I assumed it was either going to be the most obvious thing ever in like a poli-sci major or the weirdest major on earth. Like, oh no, this guy was actually a biology major, a pre-med or something.
So during his first stint at University of Michigan in the early 60s, Ayerwood was part of a fraternity, and he would also meet art student Ruthie Stein, who he, quote, was a brilliant painter and radical thinker who first introduced him to the world of activism. He found himself surrounded by student activists and politics. He was stunned to find out that the movement was also filled with strong women who were fighting not only for their own liberties, but who were also conscious of the intersections between their struggles and those of other marginalized people. This is a quote from Bill Ayers' book, Fugitive Days. The place was weighty with women. I was like a bee in a honeypot, everything golden and delicious and sticky. I felt lucky to be in a place so concentrated with such beautiful women and blessed to be living in a perfect world where generations of women were being born on every continent and in every country every day of the year. I might die here, I thought, but what a lovely way to go, wallowing with the Ann Arbor women.
Imagine you're at a party and someone comes up and hits on you. Someone's like, hey, you look real sticky.
I mean,
like, goddamn, I want to let this person inside me right now.
I mean, to be fair, I did text you yesterday saying that Bill Ayers got laid once and became a terrorist.
I mean, that probably is what kept him around for the meetings. Like, yeah. You know, he was introduced to activism, and, you know, he's young. He probably would have bounced off of it, but he's just like, I could stick around here a little bit.
Yeah.
Look how sticky all these women are.
Through his studies, Ayers was exposed to the world of political theory through people like Rousseau, Thoreau, and Marx, and very quickly began to recognize the contradictions at the heart of American society. In his own book, by his own admission, he read the Communist Manifesto, tried to read Das Kapital, but said it was unassailable and too dense. So, you know.
Well, Marx is a shitty writer. I mean, like, even people who appreciate his political ideology will probably agree with me that he doesn't have the best prose, okay? That's not a controversial statement to say, I think.
Yeah, Marx would have been better off writing YA fiction in a much more digestible form. Then maybe we live in a socialist world.
If Marx really just, you know, put his nose to the grindstone and put out the isekai he always wanted to write.
I mean, to be fair, China did make the Karl Marx anime, so...
They did.
Yeah.
I forgot about that.
That's for when we finish G Gundam.
No, no, no.
I mean, to be fair, I already posed to the people, the lovely people on our Discord, should I make Joe watch Blade Runner 2049? And
I love that movie.
No, then people's response is, no, he should make you watch Come and See.
I love that movie.
So this is another quote from Ayers. That week, Ruthie Stein, and this is kind of indicative of the political climate at the time and the activism that was going on. That week, Ruthie Stein took me to my first picket line at a pizza joint in North Maine called Angie's, where Vincent, Angie's husband and manager, had a nasty habit of refusing to seat black people. "For you, takeout only," he would say. And we ring the entrance, chanting slogans we'd heard on the news from the South and singing freedom songs. One night, Barfly showed up and led a gang of four in for a slice. And when he saw me, he cursed, pushed me and shoved me to the ground, scraping my skin off one elbow. I'd never felt happier. So this is, they're kind of doing small scale grassroots stuff, which is cool, you know.
Sure. Yeah.
Then Ayers took a bus to Detroit to meet Reverend Gabriel Starr, a leading figure in the local civil rights movement whose number he'd gotten from Ruthie. Bill wanted to help with the emancipatory struggle for civil rights, but he was a middle-class white boy from suburban Ann Arbor, so what could he do? Starr put him in touch with a possible contact.
I will say he's the first middle-class white boy from Ann Arbor to ever have anything close to this kind of introspection.
He should see, today he would have got grills. Starr put him in touch with a possible contact in New Orleans who could use some help, and so Bill tried to hitchhike his way to New Orleans. He got picked up by a truck driver around the same age as him, and asked, "Is like, you know, where are you going?" He's like, "Oh, I'm going to New Orleans." He's like, "Oh, I'm going to Baton Rouge." And Bill Ayers asked why, and the guy just responded, "Oh, easy pussy."
Look, say what you will about truck drivers, but at least they're honest. And you know, since he's going specifically to Baton Rouge to get laid, he's not going to ask you to suck his dick to drive him there. You got two bonuses going for you. You're not going to have to give him any ass to ride that truck.
They are driving from Michigan to Baton Rouge.
That is a long fucking drive.
So, while on this drive, the guy was constantly doing trucker speed. He was like telling Bill Ayers like dirty jokes and that were like he was delivering in like rapid succession of like the only a speed freak could do. And then
it's a hyper fixation, but only on racist jokes.
So then eventually the truck driver revealed himself to be very racist. He was saying like N-word this, N-word that, all my problems. Next thing, he pulls out a revolver and he's like, "First one I see down there, I'm gonna shoot."
Jesus. I mean, like, how terrified is this college kid? Like, obviously we know what Bill Ayers becomes eventually, right? But like, how terrified must you be to be locked in the cab of a truck with a guy yoked to the gills on trucker speed, constantly talking about fucking and racism, and then he pulls out a loaded gun?
I mean, like, also bear in mind, like, Bill Ayers' dad, Thomas G. Ayers, would eventually be the chairman and chief executive of Commonwealth Edison.
So he has a fair amount of, like, you know, reality shield privilege going on. And then now he's locked in a very small space with the man off of his gourd off speed waving a loaded gun around.
Yeah. So upon arriving in New Orleans, Ayers soon found disappointment as his contact turned out to be a lecherous creep who was more interested in invading Ayers' personal space than any sort of revolution. Bill, dejected, kind of bummed around the...
He wanted to liberate that ass.
Yeah, he like kind of mooched around the French Quarter before hitchhiking his way to Baton Rouge, where he ended up signing on as a merchant marine on a boat loaded with wheat bound for Greece.
Why not? As one does, you know?
Yeah, there's also another quote from... if you wonder what they got up to while he was a merchant marine... "Everywhere we stopped, Quetta, Tangiers, there was a mad dash for a nearby whorehouse and a bar where we all acted the fool and pretended to be best friends and comrades for a few hours, buying drinks, spending money, each of us armed with little syphilis assassination kits, heavy clumsy condoms, tiny alarming needle-nosed tubes of infection-fighting goo to squeeze up our shafts after sex, dispersed by Bones, the third mate who acted as the ship's nurse."
I mean, okay, as disgusting as that is exactly what I assume merchant marines are doing.
In the 60s.
Yeah. Those dudes were sticky with venereal disease.
Yeah, once again, we're coming back to sticky people.
I assume they still are as well. Like, I don't want to say that they've gotten any better. They're still sailors.
It's the only Marines we support.
That's fair. That's fair. Yeah.
Then, one day, while in Rome, Ayers was reading a copy of the Herald Tribune. The front page was about an American buildup in a country that he had never heard of before. Vietnam. Soon, Ayers was on a boat on his way back to Ann Arbor and back to his studies at University of Michigan. Fun fact that's in the book that isn't very well known, Bill Ayers was going to enlist in the army to go to Vietnam.
He liked the idea so much, he's like, nah, fuck a draft, I'll get on the ground floor.
Yeah, and his brother talked him out of it, and he never told anyone.
I can imagine it would be unpopular, yeah.
Yeah.
As a vaguely left-wing political-leaning veteran, good choice on his part. Good choice. It's not worth that smoke, man.
His choice to go back to university was informed of like what was going on at home. You see, at around this time, universities around the country had become a hotbed for radical new ideas and radical politics. This was due in part to student organizing, but also many elite universities such as Columbia, for example, who were not only involved in the R&D for the US military, but also the displacement of African Americans. Columbia in particular, in order to build a new museum, was going to displace a large part of the community in Harlem. So, in the fall of 1967, a letter written by the 100-member Columbia chapter of the SDS and signed by hundreds of students asked the university's president, Grayson Kirk, to end the school's participation in both the redevelopment of this area in Harlem, but also in R&D. The petition was ignored, and when questions about his failure to respond, Kirk replied that the letter did not carry a return address.
Okay, as funny as it would be if the return address thing mattered, right? Because, like, petitions don't get anything done, right? Like, you can submit a petition with 100,000 signatures on it, and the university's going to tell you to fuck yourself. But how funny would it be if that was actually the case? Is like, the guy at Columbia's like, man, I'd really like to listen to these students, but someone forgot to put a fucking address on this.
I have a very well thought out response. If only I had the address.
Yeah, I really wish I could engage in meaningful dialogue with these student activists, but, you know, their general secretary or whoever it is that sent out the letter just forgot their put their address on it.
Yeah. So Columbia's refusal to acknowledge its involvement in the evils of U.S. society, aka racism and imperialism, and to reconsider its own position, to reconsider its position, forced radicals into fighting back with their own kind of force. On April 23rd, 1968, Columbia students who were members of the SDS marched on administrative buildings in order to demand a removal of disciplinary action against the students placed on probation because of previous protests, and the scene eventually descended into a violent confrontation with police where they were like tearing down fences around redevelopment. There was a handful of arrests. The students then proceeded to occupy the campus buildings for the next three-ish weeks. And on the 17th...
Impressive.
Yeah. It's the 60s. What are you going to do? Like...
It's true. I mean, outside of schoolwork, yeah, it's not like you can go, play on the internet. You got to do something.
Hot chip and charging their phone hadn't been invented yet, so all they could do was lie. But on the 17th and 21st of May, this came to an end when 712 people in total were arrested over the...
Jesus.
Yeah, over the course of, like, the overall occupation. It came to an end. They were like, fuck it, you're gone. Members of the New York chapter of the National Lawyers Guild immediately set to work on the court case defending people. Among these lawyers and paralegals was Bernadine Dorn, who was the National Secretary of the SDS in 68-69 and would become a central figure within the Weather Underground.
Mm.
So, within the liberated buildings themselves, the students and their allies had adopted a new way of life that, in a sense, embodied the revolution that they had talked about for so long.
Are we talking about, like, a hippie Chaz situation going on here?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, no.
Hours were spent in long discussion of tactics, politics, and logistics of how to achieve their goals.
In addition, for most of the participants, this was the first time in their lives that they had power to use or abuse. For most, such a realization was a liberating experience and an expression of the sense of community which Ayers and others of the Ann Arbor SDS had talked about previously. It was in these spaces that divisions within groups started to form, though. Disagreements over how to develop revolutionary action among the people, what form it should take, and to what end it should be directed, were debated. Primarily, the focus was on the role of nationalism in the liberation of the nation. Progressive Labour, the Marxist-Leninist section within the SDS, said, "All forms of nationalism are weak to manipulation from the powers that be and were a distraction from the power of uniting communities around common goals rather than identity." The SDS, on the other hand, saw nationalism and national liberation as forces that weren't antithetical to each other and used the Black Panthers' black nationalism as an example of a radical force for good that used the idea of nationalism. Bernadine Dorn emphasized the Panther stance on the issue in an article entitled "White Mother Country Radicals" in New Left Notes. I'm pretty sure they're an indie band. Dorn wrote that the Panthers have been open and aggressive opponents of black capitalism and firm supporters of the line that anti-capitalism is fundamental to black liberation. So they're kind of, they're getting 50-50 right, but it's like they can't necessarily agree on things. Further on the article, Dorn elaborated that the SDS on an earlier SDS statement made after shootings by police of black students attempting to desegregate a bowling alley in Orangeburg, South Carolina, saying, "The best thing that we can do for ourselves, as well as for the Panthers and the revolutionary black liberation struggle, is to build a fucking white revolutionary movement."
Okay.
There was also some other points of contention among all the groups. One of them, women, what are they about? What do they do? I don't know.
Never a good question to come up in any of these meetings. It's like whenever Andreas Bader started talking about women, it's like, oh no.
Yeah, see, the thing is that, so obviously there's quite a lot of women that were involved in these groups. They were involved in like grassroots organizing, community outreach, but they were all arguing about like, oh, you know, are we doing enough to make them equal? Or are women suited to, you know, clerical admin? Who knows?
Should women be our equals or should we exploit them?
Keep that in mind for episode 2. Second point of contention was the role of youth in the movement. So all of these groups centered obviously around students and young people, but it being the 60s, there was a lot of young people that weren't in colleges. So the role of the uneducated and the working youth and how to radicalize them beyond just like cool hippie culture was a point of contention as well. The role of workers in the revolution. This is something I'm not going to expand on because we do talk about it in a second. And then finally, drugs. Whether drugs were a mind-opening revolutionary device or something fun to do.
Okay. I'm going to go ahead and say that they probably had a hard split on that one at some point, too.
Keep all four of those points in mind for part two. So the first major act of this new radical politics was the disruption of the DNC in Chicago in August 1968 for a demonstration organized by the Yippies and a coalition of the local Black Panthers, the Young Lords, and other radical groups. This was in part inspired by the rioting after the assassination of Martin Luther King in April. This gathering descended into chaos when over 10,000 demonstrators gathered in Grant Park on August 28th were met with violent suppression from the police. The rioting went on for 4 days and nights, and by the end of it, there were 668 arrests and 425 protesters ended up in hospital. This led to the Chicago 8 trial, which you've probably heard of, in which 8 of the organizing figures, such as Bobby Seale, were indicted on charges of crossing state lines in order to incite a riot. So, by now, the bar had been set up for what action was deemed necessary to shake up the system. By June 1969, SDS offices around the country were involved in protesting the US involvement in Vietnam. In Michigan, Bill Ayers, who had returned from his travels and resumed his studies, was now the head of the local SDS chapter, nicknamed the Jesse James Gang in Ann Arbor, and was involved in organizing pressure campaigns on faculty in the university, as well as organizing fellow students and young people to protest the draft and the mistreatment of students exercising the right to free speech.
You can't call yourself the Jesse James gang. Now, do they mean like the bandit Jesse James, I'm assuming? Okay, now the single horse.
Not the guy who married Sandra Bullock.
No, we're not sure about that. Maybe they're really into Orange County choppers. Yeah, you can't call yourself the Jesse James gang unless you're riding a horse and robbing a train. Otherwise, it's false advertisement.
I mean, they were probably doing precursors to ketamine, so maybe they were the horses. I don't know.
Whatever they're into. They're into horseplay. Clip-clop play. Whatever the fucking word is for it.
We're not invoking clopping on this fucking...
I was right. It's clip-clopping.
This is my episode, Joe.
Does that mean they get really, really, really turned on by that scene in Monty Python on the Holy Grail, the coconuts?
Imagine, you know, the first ever film of, like, the horse, like, running to, like, see whether... Or the horse galloping to see whether all four hooves were off the ground at once. That was a really pivotal moment for furries, I bet. Finally, I feel represented. Discord began to appear in the pages of the New Left Notes, and on the 18th of June, during the SDS National Convention, in that day's issue of the New Left Notes, appeared, "You don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows." This was essentially the debut manifesto of what would become the Weather Underground, its title taken from a Bob Dylan song called Subterranean Homesick Blues.
All right. I'm assuming the entire... like manifesto needs to be read in the voice of having like a 10 pack a day smoking habit.
I mean,
like Bob Dylan.
I have sections from it in a couple of sentences, so I'm going to try and do it in Bob Dylan voice. But its primary drafters included SDS members whose name will be, you know, become to be associated with the Weather Underground: Bill Ayers, Mark Rudd, Bernadine Dorn, Jim Mellon, Terry Robbins, John Jacobs, Jeff Jones, etc. The document caused a schism among various different factions of the SDS, primarily over the use of violence to achieve their means of revolution. All right, I'm going to do Bob Dylan voice for this next thing. In every case, our aim is to raise anti-imperialist and anti-racist consciousness and the tie between the working class youth and all working people to the struggles of the third world people, rather than merely joining fights to improve material conditions, even though these fights are certainly justified. This is not to say that we don't take immediate fight seriously or fight hard in them, but that we are always upfront with our politics, knowing that people in the course of the struggle are open to a class line, ready to move beyond narrow self-interest.
Well done.
It ain't me, babe. To be fair, Subterranean Homesick Blues is like Dylan's kind of statement of politics in the 60s, so it makes sense. Also, fun fact, Bob Dylan smelled really fucking bad in the 60s.
Everybody smelled really bad in the 60s.
Like, Joni Mitchell herself being problematic in her own right for doing blackface and then putting said picture of blackface on the cover of an album.
Alright, bold choice.
Yeah,
bold choice.
She said that she hated sharing a mic with Bob Dylan because he smelled so bad.
It's impressive to smell so bad that even people in the 60s in a movement of people who all smelled awful were like, "God damn, bro. you have like cartoon stink lines coming off of you."
And then on the topic of black liberation, the more oppressed to choose in another way between allegiance to the white mother country and black leadership. As white mother country radicals, we should try to be in shops, hospitals, and companies where there are black caucuses, perhaps organizing solidarity groups, but at any rate, pushing the importance of black liberation struggle to whites, handing out free Huey, that's Huey P. Newton literature, bringing guys out to Panther rallies and so on. Just one white guy could play a crucial role in countering UAW counterinsurgency. So once again, white people vastly overestimating their importance.
You know, I'm really happy to hear that they felt so strongly about Huey Lewis in the news.
It's hip to be white.
Huey Lewis in the news, as if AI created music after you typed in the prompt, "music for white people."
So the weathermen were not statedly joining the cause of black liberation, but also the liberation of all oppressed people worldwide. Subsequently, they also identified the importance of young people in the movement in their dispatch towards a revolutionary youth movement. Although a few Weather members prided themselves on you're going to enjoy this, Joe. They're not that different from you. Although a few Weather members prided themselves on the reading of political theory, seemingly preferred to draw their theory from praxis. Rudd is even quoted in Kirkpatrick Sale's book, which is an account of the SES, as bragging that he hadn't read a book in a year. One book which was widely read in the collectives was Regis Debray's Handbook on Guerrilla Warfare in Latin America, Revolution in the Revolution. The importance to Weathermen of Debray's book is impossible to like overstate. It's like super important to how they operate going forward. In addition to underground newspapers and other, you know, left publications, copies of Revolution in the Revolution were found in every single Weather member's house and all their hideouts.
Okay. Okay, so they have a fandom going on.
Yeah, they're doing slash fic. Additionally, the Weather took on Debray's operational philosophy of revolutionary groups operating in small groups of cells, also called focos, in order to maintain secrecy, but to also prevent infiltration by authorities.
I assume it's kind of like a leaderless resistance type situation, right?
So broad goals would be set by a central leadership, and their methods and outcomes were determined by each small autonomous group. So broad goals were set by, you know, head of the SDS and other groups, and then
Okay. They
would undertake the action, and how that action would come about would be decided by them. While these groups were undertaking their quote-unquote missions, consciousness and information would be spread in order to raise sympathetic support for their cause. Those within the autonomous groups would form a revolutionary vanguard.
Ugh.
You love that phrase, Joe.
Nobody who's not the most fucking ridiculous loser on earth has ever seriously used those terms at any point after like 1931.
And this vanguard would uphold the ideals of the revolution, acting as examples to the uninitiated.
Just imagine the most like inflated sense of self you have to have to be like, no, only I can spread consciousness to the ignorant masses and be their banner-carrying vanguard champion.
Oh, I have a numerical value to in a second to tell you how inflated their ego was.
Outstanding. That's not often a metric that we have.
But it was in this dramatic stepping out as an organization that the Weathermen would sow the seeds of their own failure. Their decisive politics and sectarianism within the SDS and the general New Left movement meant that central leadership and the creation of a mass movement would be difficult, as disagreements over basic details and the tactics of mass mobilization of the public and the raising of consciousness necessary to create a revolutionary vanguard would give way to squabbles over revolutionary purity. Something that has
thankfully doesn't happen anymore. Everybody's got that figured out. Wait, I'm getting a text message from the United Red Japanese Army. Fuck.
So, after the convention in June, the Weathermen, alongside the Revolutionary Youth Movement 2, because we all love a sequel, were firmly in control of the SDS, with the majority of its leadership coming from one of the two groups, despite only representing 4% of the overall SDS membership nationwide, which was 100,000 people.
Wow. Okay, so they think very highly of themselves. They're Marx's purest warriors.
Weathermen and RYM2 were unified in their opposition to Progressive Labour, mostly because of its attacks on the Black Panther Party and black nationalism in general. As we said earlier on, Progressive Labour weren't a fan of nationalism. Its criticisms of the NLF and North Vietnam's willingness to negotiate to end the war.
Really? Really? They're going to sit in the confines of like Ann Arbor and like yell down at like Vietnamese soldiers and guerrillas who have been fighting for decades at this point through the Indochinese War and then the American War and probably even the Japanese occupation period, but like, and they're gonna be like, how dare you, sir? Have you no self-respect?
Yeah, they're disparaging Ho Chi Minh in between mouthfuls of Coney Dog. But any lasting unity between the two groups was unlikely because they disagreed on almost everything else, especially strategy. Both believed that armed revolution was necessary in the United States, but the timing of the revolution and the role of white workers in it were a source of much contention. By late August, Mike Klonsky, the nominal leader of RYM2, quit the National Organizing Committee for the SDS, primarily because of his opposition to the Weathermen's dismissal of the white working class as hopelessly reactionary. Time is a flat circle, Joe. When I read that line, I actually put down my book and walked away.
Look, history doesn't repeat itself, but it oftentimes rhymes.
This left both the National Organizing Committee and the national offices completely in the hands of the Weather. Bill Ayers, Mark Rudd, and Jeff Jones headed up national offices while the committee organizing the upcoming protests in the fall, comprised of Bernadine Dorn, Terry Robbins, Kathy Boudin, and the three national officers of RYM2, regarded the call for mass demonstrations in the fall as a call for a united front against imperialism, which would, by linking workers' struggles with the war in Vietnam and the black colonies, convince the masses of working people to stand against imperialism. Given the Weathermen's belief that the united front politics were not necessary in the United States because of its late-stage capitalist development, this caused some problems.
Okay, how can you... How? What was their goal here? Like, they have these incredibly broad global ideas, right? But they have... It seems like they're missing the whole middle ground where, like, they're fucking stupid.
Hold that thought. According to the Weathermen, any efforts to reform the system, the schools, the workplace, the army, etc., were merely attempts to gain more privileges for the already privileged white population.
Okay.
They also fucking hated the army.
Sure, that part doesn't surprise me in any way. Like it's like fundamentally like hating cops, hating the military. They're the armed security of the state. Got it. That part, fine. So reforming any of these things is not okay. It's impossible in their head. So like the only ideas that they have is like, let's just like spark a war that's going to kill half the country so we can destroy everything. Like, are they doing like fucking Ann Arbor year zero shit?
Joe, hold that thought.
God damn it.
Mark Rudd and Terry Robbins wrote a public reply to Klonsky's letter of resignation. Quote, here in the United States, the struggle of the people do not necessarily raise consciousness or build a revolutionary movement. Much to the contrary, they often obscure the differences between the colony and the mother country, obscure white skin, obscure internationalism.
Mm-hmm. This still answers nothing, though. Like, those are a lot of words to say nothing.
I mean, look, like Bob Dylan said, the answer, my friend, is blown in the wind. You know, like, how many roads does a man walk down before he becomes a man? I don't know.
I don't think a shortage of blow was these people's problems. Like, again, this is something super common with every terror group we've ever talked about, whether it be, you know, the darkly comical idiots who all beat themselves to death in a Japanese forest, to the, you know, the Red Army faction, to even the Republicans and Provos, right? Like, they have these incredibly huge ideas, which I'm not necessarily saying is bad, right? But it seems to be like they have no self-image of where they're currently sitting in, like, you know, like a college annex in Ann Arbor. Of like, how do you get from this group of 15 people or whatever to impacting something on a global stage with doing nothing in the intermediary? You know what I mean?
So in response to that, Mike Klonsky's view was that the working class must be won over by addressing their issues with patience and not arrogance. And he and the rest of Revolutionary Youth Movement 2 began organizing their own fall protests in Chicago. Mike Klonsky went on to be the head of the Communist Party in the US. So, whereas Bill Ayers is being quoted by Barack Obama.
Yeah, well.
Whose politics was more thought out?
Yeah, fair enough. I will say that, like,
He has a point. nobody really like I'm never going to say that I'm going to be like a social activist or a political person or anything, but like I lack the patience, admittedly. And also the will and the drive. But like there is something to be said, like nobody really likes being lectured by some ignorant pricks.
Yes, empathy is very important when you're trying to get someone on your side. But the planned protests in October were supposed to be a mass showing of the new radical politics supported en masse by the youth of the nation. But there was a little event in August that you may know about that beat him to it. Joe, have you ever heard of Woodstock?
So we're talking OG Woodstock. Where,
yeah, we're not talking Limp Bizkit, like sexual assault Woodstock.
I mean, I think the first Woodstock was just also that without Limp Bizkit.
Yeah, except it was like Jimmy Page playing the most brownest notes ever.
I think I'm vaguely familiar with Woodstock. Korn played there.
Yeah. Meanwhile, in the first 60s, Woodstock...
60s metalcore.
Yeah, like, in 60s Woodstock, they were using Korn as currency.
Yeah, but the real metalcore.
Yeah, I don't really need to go too much into Woodstock. Probably heard of it, but Woodstock represented a watershed moment in the counterculture where the anti-war new left hippie movement broke into the mainstream in the news, on television, in music, in culture. And as a reporter for the Chicago Underground paper, The Seed wrote about it, Woodstock was a massive pilgrimage to the electrified Holy Land where high-energy communism replaced capitalism because the immediate negative forces of the outside world, cops, rules, and prices had been removed or destroyed.
And also bathing.
Yes, this episode doesn't need to be 2 hours long. I am not going to talk about my particular opinions on Woodstock because...
I'm sure it was fun. That's my opinion on it.
Despite how much I love the Grateful Dead, I hate hippies. Maybe it's because I'm a punk, but, you know.
Fair enough, yeah.
But Woodstock was not without its faults. As the weathermen saw it, Woodstock was organized by large record companies and the so-called hip capitalists who sought to hijack the movement for profit.
Okay.
This expression of radical free love and free association underneath was nothing more than a money-making scheme. Because, as I said earlier, record companies were already hip to the new sound, both musically and politically. And through sponsoring publications like the New Left Notes, they could gain access to new markets.
Yeah, it's not like today where the true sound of the people, unfettered by big record labels, is, you know, SoundCloud rappers.
Yeah, your favorite Lil Xan.
Exactly. You know, the revolutionary attitude of just being sleepy all the time.
Yeah, Lil Xan, who's now bankrupt.
You know, he did a lot of legwork to deserve that.
He did a lot of Xans to deserve that. But while all this was happening, do you want to have a guess where members of the Weather Underground were?
I'm going to assume not at Woodstock.
Yeah. Do you have any locations in mind?
I already don't like these guys, so I'm going to say Ohio.
Maybe a certain island in the Caribbean very close to the United States.
They were in Cuba?
They were in Cuba meeting delegates from Vietnam and the NLF.
All right. I didn't see that coming for them. really punching above their weight in this situation, I must say.
Yeah, so like all while this is going on, they are communicating with like the NLF and the North Vietnamese. They're like exchanging information back and forth because obviously they needed information to be put in stuff like the New Left Notes and other publications. So there was communication going back and forth. How seriously they saw these people is debatable. They're not going to Jordan.
Yeah.
They're going to Akron, Ohio, maybe, but is Akron the Jordan Valley of the US?
You know, there's certain questions that should just never be voiced aloud. It's one of them.
What if Ho Chi Minh had a Coney dog?
I mean, there is a timeline where Ho Chi Minh would love some fucking Coney dogs, but the Americans told him to go fuck himself. Unfortunately, we will never get national Ho Chi Minh Coney.
The trip lasted 5 weeks and was involved tours of the Cuban countryside, long discussions, and even some work in the sugarcane fields.
I'm sorry, but that is very funny to me. Like, you know, these college kids are probably like, wait, you want us to do what?
I mean, it's people who go work for like fucking UNESCO and shit now, just like go to Africa to build wells.
Yeah, yeah. They're like a British Eton grad who spends a weird amount of time in Palestine.
Oh my god, Mace, you should have. I was having such a great time in Kenya.
Yeah, I don't worry about the other 6 months I spent in Southeast Asia by myself. But afterwards, I had the most just the most electrifying experience in Burundi.
But like, you know, when you think about it, like 100-120 years ago, all those people were just like T.E. Lawrence and Ord Wingate.
Yes. Yes. They just can't commit horrific crimes against humanity anymore for the vibes. So they have to, they work for some like some NGO or think tank that only exists to swallow massive amounts of grants and then do nothing.
Yeah, like now those guys are like shaming me for shitting in the cocaine toilet. And like, oh my god, mate, bring that Kenyan child over here. It'll look so good on the gram.
God.
Back in the US, the FBI and like, the general conservative supporters in the US Congress were convinced that the trip was for guerrilla training.
I could see that. I could see that. Or turning them into spies somehow. Like, these are both valid concerns, I think. You know, you went to Cuba to hang out with the NLF. Questions will be raised.
But the thing is, even the FBI sources in Cuba and the CIA sources in Cuba were like, nah, they're just like working in the sugarcane fields.
Yeah,
they
made these dumbass white boys work in the sugarcane fields. I think we're good, guys.
Yeah. Nothing concrete came out of the meetings, but the inspiration they provided intensified the group's commitment to the struggle of the Vietnamese people and to a revolution in the US. October 8th, 1969 was set as the date for what would become known as the Days of Rage.
Oh yeah, I've heard this one before. I mean, the Days of Rage now is just something that like Alex Jones likes to repeat a lot.
October 8th was set as the date, and on the 6th of October, they started to arrive into Chicago, and their supporters didn't have anywhere to stay. The places they'd organized to stay were closed.
Logistics is hard.
So they had to find beds, sleeping on benches, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, thankfully, the Constitution does not cover having random militant college kids be quartered in your home. They're only soldiers.
So when the Days of Rage began, the weathermen found that they had a bit less than the tens of thousands of supporters they expected to show up.
Underestimate that, did they?
Yeah, there's a couple of hundred. When they gathered...
Oof, that's embarrassing. Good thing they didn't like, you know, block out hotel rooms or something like a wedding party. And, you know, they expect like, oh, like 20,000 of my fellow militant vanguardist folks are going to show up. It's like, oh, actually just like Pete and Jim from Akron.
It's like, oh, yeah, my dad works for, I don't know, like GM. And like,
I have a summer internship waiting for me at General Dynamics. I'm here to do militancy.
I'm going to be in a fucking, like, assistant to a senator in, like, 2 years. So they were all fairly well protected and decently armed. So a lot of them wore football helmets and shoulder pads and motorbike helmets, while others carried steel pipes, chains, baseball bats.
No guns, though, oddly. I mean, it's America, right? Like, they can just... I mean, it's America in the 60s. You could buy some decent fucking hardware at any store. I'm not saying, like, you know, do a mass shooting or something, but, like, you're calling it the Day of Rage and you're plotting a violent revolution, yet you're armed with a chain. Like, you were literally bringing a knife to a gunfight. Actually, you didn't even bring a knife to a gunfight.
You brought a stick to a gunfight.
Yeah. And you know what? That only works for, you know, members of, like, the Divine Fists of the Boxer Rebellion, not you, Chad.
But despite the disappointing turnout, the leadership of the demonstration eventually showed up in full camouflage fatigues, and then the speech-making began.
Oh, you hate the army, yet you dress in camouflage. Interesting.
Yeah, also, why are you wearing, like, camo in an urban environment?
You should have just wore a fucking Bulls jersey. That's camouflage for Chicago.
You're just wearing like the babe red, orange, and yellow camo pants.
Oh, fuck yeah.
It's looking like a Modern Warfare 2 lobby.
Everybody's gathered around their babe camo, and then there's this one guy wearing a Blackhawks jersey and a Bulls hat. They're like, I'm good. No one's gonna fucking notice me.
Yep, so they acknowledge that the turnout was a bit disappointing, and they appeal to all those present that they were the only non-racist whites in America and the only true revolutionaries willing to put their lives on the line to fight the Chicago police.
Alright, that's one hell of a title to give yourself. Like, that's, I believe the term would be that's some moxie that they have.
There's one problem with that, Joe.
Were they all white?
It wasn't true. In fact...
Of course it wasn't fucking true. Nobody has to stand at a podium and loudly announce they're the least racist white people in America. You shouldn't have to say that. It only raises more questions.
In fact, 2 weeks earlier, nearly 10,000 activists showed up to fight police in the exact same park in a demonstration against the Chicago 8 trial.
They missed that one, huh? They didn't get the invitation?
They didn't check the Google calendar. The first night, the demonstrators marched south towards the Drake Hotel, where Judge Hoffman lived. Hoffman being the presiding judge over the Chicago 8 trial, and they were breaking windows of cars and storefronts along the way. After they charged police barricades, the police put down the riots with their own counterattacks using tear gas, nightsticks, guns... and cars.
Cars?
Yeah.
Look, I know it probably means that they ran over protesters with their cars, but part of me likes to think that like the police brutality infrastructure had increased to the point that like, no, we've invented a trebuchet that just launches police cruisers at protesters. We've had to think outside the box just for funsies.
While some of the weathermen were shot by police and injured, no one was killed.
That's kind of miraculous. I mean, they weren't exactly wearing body armor. Your fucking, college football helmet is not going to stop a 9mm. You're kind of fucked.
And, like, you can watch footage of this online. There is lots of footage of this riot happening. Other activists criticized the weathermen's tactics. Carl Davidson, the leader of the SDS at the time, told a local news outlet, we thought it was off the wall. We really thought it was silly, counterproductive, that it wasn't going anywhere. That's the best we thought of it. Another faction of the SDS organized peaceful marches along with the Black Panthers to protest the Vietnam War and the enduring racial inequality, drawing, thousands of demonstrators 2 weeks earlier, but the weathermen drew news coverage. So that's why it's remembered.
Why do you think that is?
It's cameras work. Like, this is the thing, is that, like, if it bleeds, it leads. It's the old fucking saying of the newspapers.
Sure, sure. But this one, the Days of Rage, got more news coverage than the other ones?
Yeah, because it was lots of white people.
Ah, see, that's what I figured. I was wondering if maybe, I don't know, there was something more to it than that. I don't know why I thought that. I should think better.
The second and subsequent third days were more muted. On October 10th, the weathermen continued their demonstrations marching through the Loop. This is Chicago's CBD, or premier business district. With over 300 protesters, the weathermen were being watched by multiple lines of riot officers and over 2,500 National Guardsmen who were brought in that day.
Don't worry, I think like Hoyt and his Ann Arbor friends really like their odds in this situation.
So, despite being watched by the police and 2,500 National Guardsmen, they eventually broke through the lines and started smashing
what the
car
fuck?
Windows.
How? That's
worked up white boys.
I'm gonna give them the first compliment. I didn't respect your game. I didn't expect the baped camouflage Monster Energy Brigade to bust through like 5-1 odds on the street.
Yeah, you were not familiar with their game.
I was not. I retract many of my statements, but that is impressive. That is very impressive.
They smashed, car windows, storefronts, This only lasted for 15 minutes, though. And
well, yeah, I mean, look at everybody around them.
And half of the Weathermen members were arrested.
It's one of those situations. I don't I'm not exactly sure how many of you it's going to take to whoop my ass, but I can see how many you're going to use.
The following day, the Weathermen rallied at a statue of a policeman that they had bombed a few days earlier.
Okay, so they're really blowing things up at this point.
Yeah, but these are very small scale, like bit more than a firecracker, but not like a bomb that could blow up a building.
Okay.
So they once again tried to head to the loop, clashed with police, and it ended up being a vicious melee that resulted in 300 arrests and 48 police injuries. And the number of injuries to protesters is quote unquote unknown.
Most of them, I would assume. Certainly everybody that got arrested.
Yeah, like famously during the confrontation, Richard Elrod, who was a state prosecutor, broke his neck, leaving him paralyzed from the neck down.
Jesus, how the fuck did that happen? Just get his ass whooped?
Elrod said he tried to tackle a 22-year-old protester who then kicked him in the neck with steel-toed boots.
What? They use it like, I tried to tackle a pro. First of all, you're an attorney. Why are you tackling a protester? And then this protester whipped out like a fucking crane kick wearing steel-toed boots and knocked his fucking head off?
Well, Flanagan, who was charged with the attack on Elrod, who was acquitted of all charges, we bear that in mind.
Shocking.
Claimed that Elrod hit the concrete wall when he dove at him, so he just like dived head first into a wall.
He just literally stepped out of the way.
Yep.
I was gonna say I'm willing to bet that one of the fucking protesters just hit him with a goddamn tombstone pile driver, and you know.
Yeah, he RKO'd him.
Nobody expects the RKO out of nowhere during the Days of Rage.
The left wing RKO, but. With that...
The revolutionary knockout, baby.
Mm-hmm. But with that confrontation, the Days of Rage ended. The Weathermen had, in some ways, brought the war home, which was their goal throughout all of these demonstrations and since the publication of their manifesto.
That tracks with what I expect, yeah.
But the protests also bolstered their reputation as the police, as the enemy of the people, and hurt the causes they espoused by associating anti-war and anti-racism protests with violence in the eyes of the public.
That could be alienating, yeah.
In a long magazine feature, unabashedly sympathetic to the police and the city that ran the month after the Days of Rage, the Chicago Tribune claimed that the police widely condemned scarcely a year ago for their violence, which led to the Chicago 8 trial and their conduct during the Democratic Convention, had never enjoyed so much public acclaim.
Right. Like, I'm not saying this as like I support the police or anything, obviously.
Fuck the police.
Yeah, but like if you are a normal person at home who is critical of the war and critical of racism, which those people did exist, right? Like, it's not going to look great if someone espousing the same ideas as you is like chain whipping cops in the street and, you know, shit like that. Like, I know we laugh about the stuff on the show because to us it is funny. It is very funny that an attorney broke his fucking neck Superman diving in a protester. That is funny to me. However, you know, if you're like, if your mom and dad or whatever are watching TV at home, people with that have progressive ideas that are not radical, like, they won't look at that favorably, right? Like, the decency situation of everything, right?
Most of the members of the Weathermen were arrested and were bailed out within a week by their friends and family. According to law enforcement records...
Mom, come pick me up from Revolutionary Jail.
Hold that thought, Joe. According to law enforcement records, there was a total of 284 arrests, 40 of them on felony charges and several serious injuries.
And their parents came up with that money?
Yep, because they're all like trust fund kids. We'll talk about this in the next episode.
Okay. So that bit about how privileged they were actually wasn't a bit, that's just their life.
I mean, like, look how much of the Weathermen like came from like Columbia or other elite universities.
That's true. Fair enough. Yeah. They didn't just get on there on like, you know, merit. That's not a thing that happens. Nobody's like, no, I got into an Ivy because of like hard work and good grades.
Of those arrested, 104 were college students, mostly from the Midwest and New York. Another 20 were high school students, and the rest were either part-time or full-time activists. 57 police were hospitalized, and over $1 million of damage was caused to the property in the city of Chicago. The failure of the Days of Rage and the subsequent SDS convention in Flint, Michigan, which would go on to be called the War Convention in December, would be the true turning point for the Weather Underground, and that is where we will pick up next episode.
All right. I gotta say, I don't know what I was expecting. I don't know much about the Weather Underground. Like, that part in the beginning wasn't actually a joke. I know nothing. I have to say, I'm kind of impressed with how, let's be honest here, a group of overly privileged, arrogant dickheads was actually capable of some pretty serious on the ground shit. Like, and there's more of it, you know, there's more to it than like marching around and whatever, which is impressive on its own to organize and everything. But like, to go toe to toe with the entire Chicago Police Department and thousands of National Guardsmen, and they end up in the same hospital as you. It's just like, look, man, I don't necessarily agree with everything you're doing, but that is impressive.
Yeah, credits where credit's due. And like, to be fair, you know, those the figures of the arrests, like 284 arrests, only 104 were students. Like, there was a lot of people who were like, they were like hardcore activists and organizers who were like very familiar with scrapping with the police.
Yeah.
Were there as well. Like, their numbers
were... Bill Ayers was like known for being a street fighter at that point. No, he had to find other people that were. Which, you know what? Fair enough. Good on him for noticing.
Yeah, sometimes you need a Joe to do your Joe work.
We're all good at something, okay?
Yeah, exactly.
I'm never going to say I'm good at organizing. I am good at some things.
So we will pick up part two of the Weather Underground next week. If you want to hear me talk more about history, I have another history podcast called Beneath the Skin, show about the history of everything told through the history of tattooing. And Joe, you have this show.
I do normally. This is the only podcast that I host most of the time. And if you like what we do here, consider supporting us on Patreon. Just $5 gets you years and years and years of bonus content and our entire back catalog, as well as Discord access, every regular episode we do early, stickers, ebooks. One half of Tom's mustache will be mailed to you via the Chicago Police. That's not true. But yeah, you get stuff, and you keep this show running and buy your research materials, pay all sorts of cool stuff, which we then turn into content for you to consume with your ear holes. That's my sales pitch. I'm not good at it. That's all I got.
And, until next time, don't get VD in Tangiers.
Don't tell me what to do.